Hi, it's Michael Schneider, and thanks for listening to The Spinoff. Just like the critically acclaimed TV shows we discuss on The Spinoff, KCRW's storytelling podcast, Unfictional, is full of that raw human emotion that keeps us tuning in. It's got intimate stories and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. So you ought to check it out. Find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider, the executive editor of TV Guide magazine, and this is The Spinoff. Joining me on the podcast, as always, is Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. Hello, Joe.
Aloha, Miguel.
Aloha. And we're thrilled to be joined by Ninochka Khan. She's the creator and executive producer of Fresh Off the Boat, which is just weeks away from wrapping up a very successful freshman season on ABC. Hello, Notch. You told us we can call you Notch.
Please do. Hi. Hi,
welcome,
you guys.
Welcome to the show. Before we begin, actually, a cool little side note. Well, cool for us. Before we talk about Fresh Off the Boat, I have to mention, so you were born in Las Vegas, but mm-hmm. you grew up, you were raised in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And of course, Mr. Adalian lives in Vegas. He grew up in Vegas. And as we were just talking beforehand, you and I both went to high school in Hawaii at the same time.
Isn't that amazing?
So different parts of the island. But
I did not know that.
Small world.
I combine you guys. I'm the connection between you and Joe.
And Las Vegas sort of is like, what do they call it? The something island?
It's the other island. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's so many direct flights for gambling weekends from Hawaii.
Yeah.
And we can get Dole Whip here too. So it's basically like being in Hawaii.
Exactly. Many locations of L&L barbecue. So just to get folks back up to speed, if they haven't seen the show Fresh Off the Boat, it's a comedy based on Eddie Wong's memoir of the same name about his experience being an 11-year-old kid in 1995 and moving from Chinatown in Washington, D.C. to the suburbs of Orlando, Florida, so his dad could open a steakhouse restaurant. So a lot of the show's about Eddie's attempts to fit in at his new school or convincing his mom to let him go to a Beastie Boys concert or buy him some bling. Bling. You like that? So we should say Eddie loves hip-hop culture, and it's that classic early 90s hip-hop culture that I think Adalian and I love as well. But it's really about the whole family trying to find their piece of the American dream. So it's a very funny show. It's very edgy, but it's got some heart, too, which sort of makes it a difference, I feel like, in this sort of TV landscape. So along with shows like Black-ish and Cristela, it's also one of the several new ABC series with a diverse cast. So Notch, let's start off by talking about how the show's doing. ABC put it on Tuesdays at 8 o'clock, and when they first announced that, you were probably thinking, uh-oh.
I mean, here I'm like, go. All right, well, our lead-in is Wheel of Fortune, so that's challenging.
Yes, yes. That older middle America crowd that's ready to watch a show called Fresh Off the Boat.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I saw one of the weeks, I tuned in, and Wheel of Fortune was in Hawaii because they all had Lays on, and I was like, oh, that's their sweeps. Like, maybe we're going to get a little more viewers tuning in because now Wheel of Fortune's in Hawaii this week.
Yeah.
It wasn't our preferred time slot, obviously. Notoriously, ABC doesn't do comedies on Tuesday, or they try to do comedies and they don't succeed. And the competition was really tough. You know, that's NCIS, and then The Voice came back, and it was challenging. And I had a show on ABC Tuesdays before that wound up getting canceled, so for me specifically, I was like, oh, no.
Deja vu.
Another Tuesday on ABC.
Yeah.
But the network did, I mean, to their credit, they did at least learn their lesson a little bit from other things, and that they at least gave you that nice send-off on Wednesday nights where your first two episodes were sort of double pumped, as we say in the industry, at 8:30 and 9:30. I mean, was that a signal that you thought, all right, well, maybe there's some hope and maybe they really are behind us and they're not just giving me lip service?
Absolutely. And, you know, when Paul Lee called to tell me about the time slot, he was like, I know how it sounds, but here's how we're going to launch the show, and we're going to double pump you. And that's a big thing. We've never done that before for a new show. And we're going to give, you know, a lot of promotion, a lot of press. We love the show and we want it to work. We know it's a tough time slot. So our expectations are, you know, normal. Like, we don't expect you to do something that that people don't do. And then they launched us on that Wednesday, and we moved to the following Tuesday, and we had two new episodes. So within the course of a week, we aired four episodes, and it's been amazing.
Yeah, it opened strong on Wednesday, and then that audience actually moved to Tuesday with it.
It was incredible.
For a show that had no lead-in, and it wasn't paired with anything,
it's
done quite well.
I know.
Do you think now, I mean, obviously we still have to get the official season 2 renewal. It seems hard to imagine that it won't be back, but Do you have an opinion or even want to express an opinion as to whether or not, you know, you're working on Tuesday? Okay. A lot of us still believe, though, that if you were moved to Wednesday night, which is still the stronger night of comedy for ABC, and you had some love and support behind another ABC established sitcom, that you could have an even wider audience. So although as a producer, you don't necessarily get a vote in this process, if you could vote, would you want to offer an opinion?
I mean, you know, I'd vote for Obama again. That's what I would do.
No. Spoken like a true diplomat.
Honestly, you know, the Wednesday night is a hugely successful night for ABC. You know, that's where their family comedies live. They have great shows, every single one of them. So if we got that news that we were moving to Wednesday, I wouldn't be upset. I'd be like, that's fantastic. If we get the news that we're staying on Tuesdays and they're pairing us with, you know, something established or something new, I'd be happy too, because I think that sort of the unknown, like the big question mark, is kind of behind us. You know, like, will people watch a comedy on ABC at Tuesday, you know, and will people watch an Asian American Family? You know, it had been so long since there was a comedy starring an Asian American cast that that was a big question mark. You know, people didn't really know. And the fact that America has embraced this show so much, you know, and we get, you know, almost 7 million viewers, I think, a week once the, you know, plus threes and plus sevens are all counted, like, it's incredible, you know, and so I'd be happy either way, really.
Well, let's talk about there was such a hunger for this show. I remember the week that it debuted on Twitter, you know, there were viewing parties, there were people organizing events throughout the country.
Yeah.
When you were developing this show, was the weight of the importance of this show at all on your shoulders? I mean, let's talk about the fact that this is the first show with a predominantly Asian American cast on prime time in 20 years since All American Girl.
Right.
And of course, that must have been something that was kind of always in the back of your head.
I mean, I obviously knew that. I think when we got the pickup for 13 for season one, you know, we knew we were going to be mid-season and we knew we were going to wrap production before we aired. And in my mind, once I heard that, I was like, okay, good, because now I can just focus and we can all just focus on making a really funny show with relatable characters, with interesting stories, and we'll be able to sort of make it in a little bit of a bubble where, you know, we don't have to sort of react to things because we didn't know it was going to go so well. You know what I mean? We had no idea. So we just sort of had the confidence to create this world for the Wongs and create these characters and create this world. And so that was really the focus, you know, was sort of like making a really entertaining show. Because at the end of the day, it's like you can have the best intentions, and if you're not funny, if you're not entertaining, if people don't care about these characters, they're not going to come back, and then you're like a noble failure, you know, and nobody wanted that, so.
Right, and if it's not funny, then you may suffer the backlash of, well, look, they blew it. This was an opportunity, and, you know, maybe we won't see another show with a predominantly Asian American cast for another 20 years. Was there ever a pressure, a fear that people might, you know, judge the show that way, regardless of not if that's fair?
You know, I think because we knew how funny the cast was, and we knew how great the episodes were and the stories were, it was never a worry about that, you know, because our cast is incredible. You know, Constance, Randall, all the boys, even the supporting characters, you know, Chelsea Crisp, who plays Honey, Ray Wise, Paul Scheer. We felt really good about the content, you know. So, but I think, you know, yeah, I mean, you always want to be able to come out strong and have everybody think it's funny and, you know, not be sort of, oh, well, they tried to do something and it didn't work or it didn't take, you know.
What was the development process like? Talk about the studio and the network, and what were they looking for? What were their notes for you?
You know, like, they were really supportive from the get-go. I mean, so I mentioned, you know, I had Don't Trust the Bitch and Apartment 23 on ABC, and 20th was always really supportive. Melvin Marr, who was one of the exec producers with me, sent me Eddie's memoir when I was looking to, you know, see what my development projects were going to be, and I read it and, you know, I thought it was fantastic, and I really focused on the part of his story where, because it's his whole life from, you know, 0 to 30, and the part where his family moves to Orlando in the mid-90s so his dad can open a steakhouse. And I told him, I'm like, here's where I would set the show, here's how I would do it. And he was on board, Jake Kasdan was on board, the studio was on board. And then right before we were going to take it out, Paul Lee and Sami Falvey took me out to lunch, and they were like, here's why you need to bring this show back to, you know, your next show to ABC. And I was like, because for me, I was like, I didn't want to be like Charlie Brown in the football. You know what I mean? Where, like, I keep here's another show. You know, I trust you.
Yeah. Although I remember, I mean, Paul Lee was a big supporter of Don't Trust the Bee.
Totally.
He was a big fan of that show.
No, it's true. I mean, like, you know, and he said, he was like, I love Don't Trust the Bee. Creatively, we were super supportive. I mean, right up until the show got canceled, I couldn't have had a better experience at ABC. It was fantastic. But he said, you know, that brand didn't quite work for the ABC brand, but this is why this show does. Our specialty are family comedies. And he pointed to his lineup and he's like, we're committed to diversity. It's more than just lip service. We put shows on the air, you know, and we will do everything we can to get this on the air. And it was a great lunch, and they paid, obviously. So I was like, all right, I'll take this to ABC.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, because we had other, you know, NBC wanted it, Fox wanted it, and we decided to go there. And I pitched them the whole pilot story from the get-go. You know, they knew exactly what I wanted to do, and they were on board 100%.
Yeah, so. NBC made you go Dutch when they took you out. It's a different network.
Hope operating glass.
Different culture.
So, you know, Comcast, trying to say that money, cable companies. Hey, I, you know, part of the process, though, obviously, was working with and bringing in an Eddie. My publication printed a long story from him right before the launch. I mean, is that sort of, you know, in the end, whenever I've talked to you about this and seen you guys in person, everything seems pretty cool and copacetic. It seems sort of like you respect his point of view. He respects you, even though he may sort of not always sound like it. But we in the media like to make big deals out of this. I mean, has a lot of that been overblown in your mind, or has it been a challenge? I mean, what sort of, you know, anytime you're working with someone else, even though it is your creation, ultimately, it can be challenging. I'm just wondering how that's all played out, and has it changed since the show's done so well in the ratings?
Well, I mean, you know, as you say, like with me and Eddie, you know, I respect his story. You can't get more personal than writing a memoir. I mean, you're literally putting your life story down on paper, and I think that a lot of the stories he told and a lot of experiences he relayed were really powerful. And it took a lot of courage for him to write it down and not sort of whitewash it or sugarcoat it or make it palatable for anybody. And I think that in a similar way, he wrote that article for New York Magazine. And you take both of those pieces of writing, which I think are fantastic, and I think that it's so human. You know what I mean? Like, it's one guy's experience. It's only one person's point of view. Like, only Eddie Wong could have written that, you know, New York Magazine article, because only he knows what it feels like to have, like, who's to say, like, if our family stories were turned into a network sitcom that we weren't, you know, having control over, who's to say how we would all react, you know? And I really appreciated that humanity that came through, and it was very relatable on that level to me, you know? I do think it's worth, you know, getting through the entire article, which a lot of people are like, oh, it's whatever, it's so long, but to me, it's really great. And you get to the point where he gets to at the end, where he understands and appreciates what this show is and what it means. And it's not to say that he, you know, is 100% on board with everything. You know, I'm sure he would do stuff differently. But the fact that he can understand that the show has a place and has and there's a need for this show and people love it. I haven't talked to him in a little while, but last time he emailed me was saying that so many people come up to him every day and thank him for the show, and just from all different backgrounds, all different nationalities, and they say how important it is that the show exists, and, you know, he appreciates that.
Do you think that article also came out of, I mean, he was nervous at first. I mean, this was before the show had launched,
right.
So, you know, this was sort of putting his life on the line. Now, looking back, the show's successful, and I imagine he's getting nothing but, you know, attaboys from people out there, and he's probably much more comfortable with it than he was at the time. But that must have been a little freaky, and it seemed like that was the point where he was probably starting to panic a little bit. Oh, wow, this is happening.
Yeah, probably. You know, I think that for him to sort of appreciate and realize that, you know, that this wasn't, you know, like we always said, a documentary. This is not a biopic. This is, you know, fictionalized versions of his family. So the Wongs on ABC are going to do and say things that the real life Wongs have never done or said. And for him to sort of wrap his head around that and then, you know, be nervous because, you know, this is made up now. Like, this is not his thing. And then to see the response, you know, I'm sure he was nervous. And then to see the response, you know, I mean, I'm not sure that he follows the ratings that closely or that he even, you know, cares about that stuff. But I think that what he does care about is the response that people, you know, that viewers have reached out to him and said, you know, how much this means to them and how important it is and how, you know, it's made them feel less alone. And I think that that's incredible when you're talking about a family sitcom at 8 o'clock on ABC, you know, that it really has touched people. And I think, and look, you're not going to please everybody, obviously. So, yeah, you know.
By the way, do you think it would ever be possible or just too weird and creepy and meta to ever have Eddie guest star in the show? Obviously not as himself, or maybe in a flash forward. I don't know. Maybe that's the final episode. But would that just be too cheesy? And naturally, I like things that are cheesy. So that's why I'm suggesting this. But
I don't know. Well, if you look closely, you can see him cameo in the pilot.
He is
in a scene in the pilot. I mean, I can tell you which one, or I can let you.
go watch it again on Hulu. Yes. All right. Well, there's an incentive to go watch it again.
Going back to sort of the development of the show, talk a little bit about the casting, because, you know, first off, I think a lot of people will agree, including the critics, that Constance Wu is sort of the big revelation of this show. I mean, Randall Park obviously is someone that who we've seen in the past. You know, he was he's been in movies and other TV, but Constance Wu is sort of a fresh face, and she's really sort of taken the show by storm, and yeah. There's even discussion perhaps of Emmy hopes. You know, talk about that character and writing this strong female character that you could have dangerously gone close to caricature, but instead you've gone the other direction and you've made her really probably the smartest one in the room.
I mean, for me, you know, that's my favorite thing is to write strong female characters, you know, in an unexpected way. Like, yes, to not go to where you think this character is going to go to and just surprise people. And I think that's what Constance is so great at, you know, when she came in to audition. Because as you say, like, I don't think she'd ever done comedy before. I think she'd done, like, a couple of small things here and there. She came out of nowhere and she killed it from the beginning. And she delivered stuff in such a way, like, her timing was so original, you know, and it's not anything that, you know, the way you hear lines in your head as a writer. She did it differently and better. And, like, that's when you know you have, like, this sort of – I mean, it doesn't happen often. You know, Kristen Ritter is somebody like that in, you know, Don't Trust the Bitch. And they just elevate the material. So that just makes – they're, like, the writer's best friend. You know, they make you seem like a better writer because they're so good.
I love, by the way, that you still refer to it as Don't Trust the Bitch. I mean, sorry, ABC.
I mean, yeah, I can't let it die.
It was Don't Trust the Bitch in Apartment 23. Let's just call it like it is.
Let's just say what it is.
But talk about the casting. I mean, how difficult was it to cast this show?
It was challenging, you know. I mean, Randall Park was the first piece of the puzzle. We knew we wanted him as the dad. He's so funny. I love him in Veep. I think he's hilarious. Yeah. And Jake and Melvin had worked with him on Jake's movie Sex Tape. So we wanted him immediately, and so we got him. And then Constance, as I said, you know, was a find, and she just killed it from day one. And the boys, we did a nationwide – actually, we went into Canada, just casting search. We did Vancouver, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, New Jersey, Boston, Hawaii, and we just had open calls for kids. And the two younger boys, Ian Chen, who plays Evan, and Forrest Wheeler, who plays Emery, were local. So they came in, and they were just amazing. And then, you know, Hudson Yang put himself on tape from New York, sent us his, you know, audition. He was super raw, but he had that sort of quality that we were looking for, that sort of swagger, and that we weren't finding. You know, we saw a lot of polished kids, a lot of sort of Nickelodeon-type kids, you know, who came in with, like, the big gestures and the big smiles.
Right.
I mean, that's a business that someone needs to start, by the way, is, like, un-Nickelodeon-ing kids. Un-Nickelodeon-ing kids.
No JonBenet Ramsey's.
Yeah, I know. Just, well, like, natural.
Yeah, well, because those kids are all, I mean, that's big comedies with sort of, you know, the jokes
are just broad.
Thrown at you, like, they're forced over your head with the
laugh track. You have single camera kids.
Yeah, exactly. So, and Hudson had that. You know, he was raw and he'd never done anything, right? No.
That's pretty impressive. And he comes in with this swag, like you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, where does that come from?
Just inherent. We flew him out, you know, we worked with him, we put him, you had him do a screen test, and he was just great. I mean, he just had that, you know, obviously you have to work with him on understanding how to work to the camera and where you look and things like that, and don't look at the lens and those kinds of, like, industry things. But he had that natural ability. It just came out of him. You know, and you saw him on camera and you were like, I'm rooting for this kid. It was the Kevin Arnold syndrome that we, you know, where you just are rooting for him.
And nobody is a better – he's one of the best face actors on television. I mean, he has – just with his looks, he can – just his eyes, his facial expression, he can convey so much, which, again, is – he can take what you put on the page and then combine what he does. And it just, to me – let's get an Emmy nomination for him.
I totally agree.
Had did he spend much time with Eddie? So, because one of the things that's also amazing is having met Eddie at the Television Critics Press Tour, you sort of see Hudson really is sort of playing – you know, this is how I imagine maybe Eddie kind of was when he was that age.
Yeah, I mean, I think he spends as much time with Eddie as he possibly can. You know, I know he loves Eddie, he worships him, and, you know, I don't know how much he's studying him, like, in an actor way, but I think, you know, he loves being around that sort of energy. And I think Eddie even told Hudson at one point, you know, like, don't worry about copying me or mimicking me, just make it you, which I'm sure was great for Hudson to hear, you know.
Well, you know, speaking of the Television Critics Press Tour, we were all there in January.
Yes.
When one of the very first questions that was asked of you, we call it Chopstick Gate. uninformed reporter asked a rather offensive question about the show, which it was astounding. I mean, we were all sort of, our jaws were open. Unbelievable.
That is so, the craziest part is no one can tell who that woman is. Like, no, every person has been like, we don't know who she is. She was whisked away. Like, I've never.
What were you guys thinking on the stage at that moment? I mean, I
thought it was a bit. I thought it was somebody, like one of the writers had snuck in and was doing like a joke question.
Well, and we should, for our listeners who obviously weren't there, we should explain the very first question at the Fresh Off the Boat panel at the TCA was a woman who said, you know, I love Asian things. I love chopsticks. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly what she said, but I love chopsticks. You can have some of those. You can have chopsticks on your show.
Right. I saw there were chopsticks. Are you going to have more chopsticks in the show or something like that?
Right. Something like that.
I think we all, I mean, I would be interesting to go back and like look at the response. I think it took everyone a second because I honestly thought it was a joke. Like it was going to be like, seriously, here's the real question. So we all sort of started laughing and sort of joked about it because it was, I mean, I don't really know how to respond to that sort of question.
It sort of became a long-running joke during the rest of the panel.
We kept having callbacks to the joke. Yeah. But it's like, for me, it really just showed like, wow, like this is, I mean, ostensibly a journalist like in the middle of this room. You know, I don't know who she is or where she was from, but like, this is a question that this woman is asking. And like, is this where, this is where the conversation is at? You know, like there has been no representation of Asians or Asian culture or anything like that on primetime network television in so long that this is a real opinion. Like this is someone's opinion here. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
It was so crazy.
Right, right. There's still a lot of ignorance out there because there hasn't been an opportunity to.
And it wasn't mean-spirited. It really was just sort of ignorant. You know,
right.
Like she thought she was saying like, I love Asian culture. You know, she started out in a positive place.
Right,
but it was crazy.
Well, speaking on a similar note lately here in Hollywood, we've also been, and actually it's not just been Hollywood. This has broken out across the country and it's been on the cable news networks. Deadline Hollywood, which is an industry trade online, recently published a story sort of awkwardly asking the question of whether or not there was too much diversity now in casting going on, and that some agents, and in fairness to the author of the article, she was trying to make the point, which is a real point and reflecting the real opinions, and this is sort of the scandal of some talent agents who are worried that there are roles being taken away from white people now because networks are looking at diversity. What did you think when you saw the piece?
I mean, I had to read it a few times to quite understand like what the gist of it was because it was so a little bit baffling, you know? I think there was something like, has the pendulum swung too far the other way or something like that?
Too much of a good thing?
Too much of a good thing, yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, you know? I mean, I'm not a talent agent. I don't know what their, what it looks like from their angle. But, I mean, for me, like for the idea of a pendulum to have swung too far the other way, it had to be swinging in the first place. Like, there was no swinging. You know, it's been static for 50 years or whatever. You know, it's like, you finally have one season where shows that reflect sort of our culture, the culture around us, are succeeding. I mean, I can't think of any way that you would think of that other than positive. It seems weird to me.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, the Hollywood is so cynical. Agents especially are extra cynical. Executives are cynical as well. Are they treating this too much as the trend of the moment, as opposed to this is just the way it should be? This is just good practice is to, cast diverse actors and sort of, you know, be much, you know, reflect much more what the viewing public looks like. Are they treating it more like, hey, we need more medical shows on the air. We need more shows about friends living in the city together, and then now we need more, minorities because Empire is a hit.
Right.
Are people being cynical, or are they casting for the right reasons?
Well, I mean, I think that there's always the trend, you know, the trends that come out every season. There's whatever works the previous season, that's the new thing. So, as you say, like medical dramas or family sitcoms or whatever it is, or Two Girls in the City, that's, you know, a slew of those get developed. So, probably there is some of that, you know, the trend sort of following and, oh my God, Empire's a huge hit. But I think the way to sort of circumvent that and sort of cut that off is to prove that that's not the case, you know, and to have other shows come out that sustain the premise of this is not just a trend. This is something that people really want to see. This is reflecting of the things that, you know, when they walk out their front door, like, you know, the country around them, and that everyone's experience is different, you know. So I think that the way to sort of keep that going is just to keep new shows coming, you know, and to keep the audience for the existing shows, you know, building.
And let me ask you, because, you know, this has come up a lot lately in the world, and there's flat out racism that you know it when you see it. And then there's instances where people are coming, you know, and I'm speaking as a white man, who are coming from it from not necessarily a bad place, but just an ill-informed place or mm-hmm. a generational place that's different. And is there a way that there can be sort of that these moments can be teachable learning moments where people sort of who are of open mind can say, oh, okay, I get that. All right, this should evolve without necessarily being burned to the ground by those who are sort of trying to educate?
Absolutely. I think there's so many teachable moments. And I think that what you're talking about is actually the kind of comedy that we're doing in the show, where it's a very mm-hmm. inclusive brand of comedy. You know, like, we're not excluding anybody. We're not saying like, oh, if you're not from an immigrant family, you're not going to get this. Oh, if you're not Asian, you're not going to get this. You know, we're saying there's a lot of different access points to one story. And in those access points, maybe you'll find something that you can relate to. And if you've ever felt like an outsider, I think you'll relate to the Wongs. If you've ever, you know, for whatever reason, for religion, sexuality, your parents couldn't afford to buy you Air Jordans, the music you listen to, whatever, if you've ever felt like you don't belong, this is a show for you. And I think that that inclusiveness of the, you know, the tone and the comedy is similar to what you're talking about, Joe, because it's like we're educating people. We're not vilifying them. We're saying, look, you were wrong. This is why you were wrong. If they do it again, then there's a problem. You know, then they're like not hearing or whatever. Maybe they have a different mindset. But, you know, I mean, we always come from it where, in, you know, like, you want to believe that people just don't know and you want to educate, as opposed to believing that people know and are purposely, you know, being racist or hateful or something like that.
After the break, we'll talk pilot season politics and also what it's like to work on a show that suddenly disappears. From KCRW, this is The Spinoff.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW Music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
We're back. It's The Spinoff. I'm Michael Schneider, the executive editor of TV Guide magazine and also a contributor to the new website, TV Insider. Find us at tvinsider.com. Here with me is Joe Adalian of vulture.com and special guest Nadochka Khan, creator of the new hit comedy Fresh Off the Boat on ABC. So, Notch, let's talk about your past. So okay. we talked a little bit about Don't Trust the Bitch.
Yes.
But you started in animation. You started on Pepper Ann.
I did. I started on Pepper Ann right out of college, and Sue Rose, who was the creator of the show, was an illustrator. And so I got paired with her. You know, she was trying to turn like a comic strip for Young Miss magazine into a TV show. And she, for some reason, was like, oh, I'm going to hire this girl. Like, I had no credits, no any, you know, I had a bad spec, you know, Larry Sanders show, I think, that
yeah.
she read.
So she's like, this woman's perfect
this
for
woman
kids
gets
TV.
It. Yeah, this woman gets it. Meanwhile, I was like getting drunk every night and, you know, trying to write on Saturday Night Live. So I don't know what she saw in me. But she, so I did the pilot with her, and then we got picked up for, you know, a bunch of episodes. And I got to hire my friends from school who were like temping and giving tram tours at Universal Studios. I was like, hey, do you want to come write on this show? They're like, yes, please.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was great. We did 65 half hours. That was like grad school for me, honestly. Like, I really got to see how a TV show got put together from the beginning to the end and experience things like post and, you know, the spotting sessions and music and editing. Like, it was incredible.
And at the same time, you were still sort of writing specs for other shows, and you did some work on Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah, I was on Malcolm in the Middle in 2002. That was my first primetime job. And then that was my first, like, live action experience, which was cool.
You know, what's interesting is obviously Malcolm, back in those days, it was sort of a novelty to have a single camera sitcom. It was one of the first that became a big
especially
hit.
Especially a family show. Yeah.
Yeah. And in some ways, you know, Fresh Off the Boat kind of reminds me a little bit of Malcolm, that it's sort of the next generation of that edgy single camera family comedy. I mean, did you kind of learn anything on that show that you maybe still apply these days?
I mean, I thought that the way they told stories was really interesting, you know, and I like that it was through the main kid's point of view. I thought it was very visually cool. You know, they were doing stuff that I'd not seen done before in single camera. You know, it wasn't sort of static. There was a lot of movement.
Yeah.
And it almost reminded me a little bit of animation,
yeah.
you know, the way that the visual style of that. And I think, like we talked about trends earlier, like that begat so many, you know, other shows that tried to be like that, you know, and didn't, none of those worked.
Yeah. Well, I still think, I mean, to me, The Simpsons sort of informs every sitcom on television.
That's interesting.
Now. Every comedy sort of owes a debt to just the way they pace things now, the way they flashback, they quick cut to things.
Totally.
It's all The Simpsons.
Totally. I think that's really true.
Yeah. And you also, I didn't even realize this, but you also worked on American Dad and,
yes.
and the whole Seth MacFarlane empire. I mean, that seems like a different environment. What was it like being in that world?
It was amazing. I mean, I was there for 6 years from the beginning.
Wow.
Yeah, I was there. I started as like exec story editor, so I was low level. And I worked my way all the way up to exec producer. And I learned so much, you know, Seth and then Mike Barker and Matt Weitzman, who co-created American Dad with him. Those guys taught me so much. The main thing was that, you know, sitcoms have to be funny. Like, shows have to be funny. Like, stories have to be interesting and everything like that. But at the end of the day, there has to be laughs. You know, that can't just be like a smile show. And I really appreciated that. You know, I really took that away with me when I went on.
Now, the stereotype to me, of especially in that world, is it to me, I imagine it smells like a locker room there. That it's like a guy's place. I mean,
there was a lot of dudes.
Yeah,
it was like an Alaskan fishing boat in there. It was just like guys everywhere you looked. There was a couple other women. Laura McCreary was another writer that was on staff pretty much the whole time I was. I think she came the second season. And, you know, it was funny because there was like maybe 16 writers or 18 writers. It was a big room. There were two women and they would often split us up into two rooms. Mm-hmm. So like each room could have like a female voice, you know.
So that's
funny.
Well, that's funny, but it's got to be tough at the same time. I mean, people can't help but, you know, turn to you like, all right, you know, let's get the female perspective now. I mean,
right. They're what do you think? I'm like, I don't know.
what's that like, though? I mean, is that's got to be a little...
I mean, you know, I think, unfortunately, that's so prevalent in so many writers' rooms that I don't think that it's weird. You know, it's that thing about, like, changing, like, sort of educating people and teachable moments. It's like that's been the norm for so long, and I think now. And, Joe, remember we did that, like, talking thing, like me, you, Liz, Merriweather, like all those female showrunners a couple years ago? It
the
started
dream season.
Yeah, the dream season. And that's really started to change, I would say, in the last 5 years? You know, I mean, not that long, where, like, you have more female showrunners, more female show creators, and that's how you sort of start to change the game. And if you don't like the sort of makeup of the room, if you think it's too male-centric, if you think there's not enough diversity, the best way to change that is to be, you know, get a seat at the table. Like, you know, get a show.
Yeah, going back to that Deadline article again, I mean, I think that's the other big point, the big takeaway too, is that actually what also really needs to change in Hollywood is the number of female executives and non-white executives. And we're seeing some of that, but, you know, is that something hopefully that will also evolve? Would you ever want to be an executive? Do you ever see yourself 15 years from now after you've created a couple more sitcoms? Do you ever think that more creatives should try to do their hands at the executive world?
Man, I mean, I would imagine there's so much, like, stuff that goes on being executive that would just bum me out, like, all the time. You know, like, politics and sort of corporate, like, thinking. I don't know if I would be into that.
Would you rather run maybe a larger production company? Is there any writer out there sort of you'd like
yeah.
to pattern your career after?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to eventually, you know, exec produce stuff, you know, like, shepherd sort of younger writers who maybe were doing their first pilots and things like that and sort of help them preserve their voice and sort of, you know, navigate through that process. I mean, Shonda Rhimes is incredible. You know, you can't help but look at her and be like, wow, like she, you know, she's got this amazing thing going on. She's herself. She's unique. She's managed to create shows that are successful, and she's managed to find other writers that she wants to work with and sort of shepherd them through. And, like, that's a cool thing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, seems like maybe the next step
would be great.
You start amass more power.
I know.
So, Notch, obviously, you know, so far the experience has been pretty good on Fresh Off the Boat. Now, the last experience was good, too, but unfortunately, in the end, Don't Trust the Bee didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that experience. I'm always curious. You know, these are big enterprises, a lot of people employed to make these big shows, and then suddenly like that, they go away. I mean, what is that experience like as a show creator to have something you worked on, it was your passion, it was what kept you up at night,
mm-hmm.
for it to suddenly disappear?
yeah, it's real tough. You know, like you spend years of your from the pitching of the pilot to the cancellation of the show. It's years of your life, and then it's suddenly gone. I mean, there's a lot of like crying and drinking, obviously.
Of course.
That was my first response. And unfortunately, I also had to keep editing after we were pulled off the air because I still had a couple episodes to lock. So that was rough because you're like, is this even,
right.
You still want it to be great because you still want to, they're going to have, like now they're on Netflix, which is cool. I'm glad people. But at the time there was unaired episodes that still, no one had seen. But it's tough, like you have to sort of wrap your head around, all right. You have to go away and sort of lick your wounds, I think, because you're like, I tried this thing. I loved it. I believed in it. And for whatever reason, it didn't work. It didn't click. It happens, all the time. And, it was tough. You have to sort of bounce back, or you have to decide, like, I need to check out grad schools. I need to, go to law school and figure out what, career change.
And it seemed like for you, grad school, career change,
no,
not so much.
No, I can't do anything else. So luckily. For me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Notch. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, you guys. It's been so fun.
So awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's Joe Dalian, the West Coast editor of Vulture.com, and Notch Kakan, the creator of Fresh Off the Boat on ABC. If you want to follow Joe on Twitter, you can find him at TV Mojo. And Notch, are you not on Twitter?
Guys, too many people are trying to find me. I got I owe people money.
Yeah.
Like, I can't be, I can't.
Are you on Friendster still? Maybe MySpace, kicking it old school?
I'm on the DL.
Yeah, no social media?
I think there's a private Twitter account you're just not letting us know. That's fine. You have to lurk, I'm sure, somehow.
All right. Well, and I'm Michael Schneider, the executive editor of TV Guide magazine and contributor to TVinsider.com. My Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue. That's it for this edition of The Spinoff. This podcast is produced by Caitlin Parker. Melissa Morton is our technical director. You can hear past episodes of The Spinoff on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere where you can download podcasts. You can also hear it online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. Until next time, this is The Spinoff, signing off.